everyone. It is 1 o'clock, and this is the time for the commissioners to commence our special meeting. Special meetings are when we give more than 24-hour notice of our board meetings. So we did that yesterday morning, and there was a bit of a hiccup in the beginning of this meeting in the sense that our agenda team, which consists of many people here, especially Mr. Mogrohiesky and Commissioner Buck and myself, we didn't plan on this meeting at our most recent agenda meeting, so there's been a little bit of uncertainty about how we got it together, but apparently four of our five commissioners said they were going to be coming to a meeting at the Lane County Public Health on Thursday. So we turned that impromptu meeting into a board meeting, and we have a number of commissioners here as well. In fact, all five commissioners present by either in person or on phone. And I'll just start by saying I want to introduce the commissioners, and then Senator Manning, and then I'll ask our county administrator and others to introduce all of our other guests. So present are Commissioner Burney, Joe Burney from Springfield on phone. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you.
We have Commissioner Jay Bozovich, who may have to step out briefly. His wife's in England, and he might have to take a phone call, but he'll be back when he can. Commissioner Heather Buck from East Lane District, myself, Pete Sorensen from South Eugene, Commissioner Farr from North Eugene District, and we're expecting Senator Lee Beyer here, and we're also very privileged to have Senator Manning here. And then I'd like Mr. Mogrohiesky, if you as our county administrator could help us introduce all of our other guests.
Great. Best if maybe we just go around and everyone introduce themselves and who they're with and their roles. So Steve Mogrohiesky, I'm the Lane County Administrator.
Dr. Lepke, Senior Public Health Officer for Lane County.
LaWanda Manning, Staffer for Senator Manning.
Greg Rickoff, I'm Chief Operating Officer for the county.
Jocelyn Warren, Public Health Manager.
Angie Albee, Oregon Health Authority, Government Relations.
I'm Kara Biddlecombe with the Public Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority.
I'm Dean Todlinger, our State Health Officer and State Epidemiologist.
And the folks on the periphery of the table.
Oh, hi. Kaylee Pierce, staff in public health.
Hi, I'm Joaquin. I'm also staff for public health.
Well, welcome. Welcome, everyone. I must say that because of the speed at which Dr. Warren arranged this special board meeting, that I had essentially in mind the idea that we would give our guest a little time to make some remarks, and then we would go down your agenda and provide some time for give and take for the commissioners and the legislators. So why don't we do that? We'll ask Senator Manning to take a couple of minutes, anything you want to say or not, and then we'll turn it over to Dr. Warren and go down your list.
You know, thank you, Commissioner Sorensen. I don't often get the opportunity to have the options saying anything or not.
I didn't want to put you on the spot.
Yeah, that's really cool and stuff. You know, I was at a Healthcare for All meeting in Corvallis last night, and I got to say, the room was packed. This is the first time I've actually gone to a meeting where there was so many interested people in this one particular topic. And it extended past the time that I'd expected. It was only supposed to go an hour, it went 2 hours. So people are really energized and about healthcare. You know, what it looks like now and the future of healthcare for all Oregonians. One of the things that I really emphasize is that the need for expanding not access. Words are very critical, but for to have medical care in some of our most rural areas is really important, and I emphasize and highlighted that part of the conversation. So I was looking at some of the handouts that you have here, in particular, vaccinations. As you know, there was a bill that we had introduced in the last session that was full of a lot of information. Misinformation, disinformation, information in general. I'm overloaded with information about vaccinations. I have to say, in my district, I have three school districts. I have 4J, Bethel, and also Junction City. The school vaccination rate in my districts are 98.5%, which only leaves open a small portion. I am concerned about the family members that choose not to do vaccinations, and I do agree with them. You know, you have your right of refusal. I want to concentrate on those vaccinations that are most required and not the optional ones, because I think that's where the water gets murky when we're talking about optional vaccinations that can be offered. While I am not and don't claim to be a doctor, I have acted as a doctor in plays before without certificates and stuff, so I'll leave that to the experts to make that argument. But I do appreciate this opportunity to be here. The housing crisis and everything else that you've been working on, Landmark. But I would like to hear from you, from your vantage point, what I can do in the Senate to help your goals and stuff be realized. So thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, and I really appreciate you being here, and as well as Mrs. Manning coming, and our guests from the state as well. I'd like to now turn it over to Dr. Warren, who will have a number of a more defined agenda, and then Alex Kyler. Are you still here, Alex?
He went down to look for Senator Beyer.
Oh, okay. Mr. Kyler and I were in the legislative committee meeting earlier today with Commissioner Farr and Mr. Mulcahy. Oh, great. Mm-hmm. Perfect timing. Welcome. Welcome, Senator Beyer. Perfect timing. I was about to launch into another part of the agenda, but you're on cue, and if you want to make any remarks at the beginning of this meeting,
just here to learn.
Just here to learn. Okay. So I think I'll turn it over to Dr. Warren, and you can go down your list of items you wanted to talk about at the agenda, on this agenda, and then I'll open it up for questions for commissioners and the senators.
Mm-hmm. Okay, terrific. Well, thank you very much, everyone, for coming together today. It's such short notice, too. We really appreciate everyone being here. We are here to talk about public health modernization, which is very exciting for us in public health. I think, as you know, and we've talked about public health transformation and public health, a strong public health system is really essential to health system transformation in our state. What is at the heart of public health is prevention. And for transformation to be successful and for real cost savings to be realized, we have to have strong prevention in our state. And that's really what public health does. So I'm going to tag team with Angie and Kara, and they're going to talk a little bit about kind of the state investment and some more at the state level. And then I'll and Dr. Pat together will talk about what we're doing here locally.
Thank you. This is Angie with the Oregon Health Authority Government Relations. And first, just to give some background or context, for the 2019 legislative session, the Oregon Health Authority put forward a policy option package of $47.7 million to fund public health modernization across the state. That would meet the goals of public health modernization. And throughout the process, we worked with our legislators, and we were very happy to get a $10 million investment on top of the $5 million that was previously invested in public health modernization. And so from there, we have some updates for you that I'm going to turn over to Kara. But I just really want to say thank you for being here. It's very important that around the state, we're partnering together to talk about how we can make sure that there's access for all Oregonians to be healthy. And we all know that public health plays a really important role on all parts of aspects of your life outside of the clinical setting. And so that's why we're here. And so thank you again.
Thank you. So this is Kara Biddlecombe with the Public Health Division at the Oregon Health Authority. And as Angie mentioned, we are in the process, actually, as of October 1st, we're able to get the new legislative investment out to communities through our contract with Lane County and the other 32 local public health authorities across the state. So this is actually the second biennium in which we've had some investment in public health modernization that's gone out to communities. In 2017-19, we had some limited funds that were available to sort of get us kick-started, and I've included for you a little handout from this region, but Lane County was a fiscal agent, and I'm sure we'll be talking about that for Lane, Lincoln, Bend, and Linton, and Lynn counties working together on communicable disease projects. And so you'll be able to see a little bit what some of the successes have been in this region through that funding. As Angie mentioned, with the additional resources, we've actually been able to work very closely under the guidance of the Public Health Advisory Board to put out funding to local public health authorities sort of in two tracks, one of which is going to continue the regional work that had started in 2017. And then every local public health authority will also receive their own funding. And so these dollars are really exciting because not only will they help to continue and grow the foundation from the 2017-19 session, but also will allow us to do some more committed work around health equity assessment and epidemiology, and really trying to work together as a public health system to move this work forward. For us, public health modernization is not just about communicable disease control or one project or another. It's really about fundamentally changing how public health services are delivered in communities and how the public health system works across other sectors. Senator, you mentioned housing. It's an extremely important partner for us in terms of dealing with health issues. But doing that work in a way that maximizes all of the resources that are going into communities and helps us to work together towards solving health problems as well as other social challenges that impact health. So as I mentioned, we've got those dollars out into communities on October 1st. So it was a really fast process that Dr. Warren was involved in many meetings, but I think we're on really solid ground to achieve some outcomes for you over the next 2 years, and sort of look forward to this being a place to kind of kick off, sum up what happened in the last biennium, as well as where we're going to be going. So with that, I think the exciting work is just hearing about what's been going on in your own community. So I'll let you all take that. Thank you.
So with the first round of funding, that was 2017-2019, as a reminder, it was a smaller amount of funding. It was the $5 million investment. So when it was allocated, it was done on a regional level. So as for a region, our region was Lane County, Benton, Lynn, and Lincoln counties together. So we partnered together on a vaccination project. We chose vaccination rates because we have challenges with vaccination across all of our counties, and we've been susceptible to infectious disease outbreaks such as pertussis, as we saw last year. So there was certainly a public health need. We were also trying to find, trying to identify a project that we could do quickly and really show results within a short period of time. We had 18 months. So we picked an evidence-based practice called AFIX that is promoted by the CDC, and implemented that using regional staff. They're actually housed right there in that office. and they would go through all four counties working with participating clinics and implementing AFIX. And what AFIX is basically it's a quality improvement program that you we do, that public health does in collaboration with the clinical community. It involves identifying gaps or missed opportunities for vaccination within clinics, and looking at the data from each clinic, working with the staff to identify new strategies to improve vaccination rates, implementing those strategies, and then testing over time. So it looks a lot like kind of classic quality improvement. And that was really exciting. We've had really great increases in Lane County particularly, and this one-pager kind of demonstrates sort of the increases across the clinics that we participated with. We had 12 clinics in Lane County. So that was, and that it was also an exciting opportunity to collaborate with our own community health centers, so that we really appreciated the ability to do that. We also had a number of smaller pilot projects that were not necessarily evidence-based practices, but things we thought could really answer a community need. And what we did here in Lane County was the Pneumovax campaign, about which Dr. Pat will speak.
Happy to do so. So if you look at the second to the last page, it looks like this. This is the specific page for the pneumococcal project. And you can read through that as I'm talking. So we've been before the board multiple times talking about the childhood immunization rate. And we have opportunities for improvement across our county, across our state. But we've not really talked a lot about adult immunizations. And when kids age into adulthood, we oftentimes kind of forget, maybe outside of influenza, that there are vaccines that will help us achieve health or retain our health. And the pneumococcal vaccine is one of those. And this is a vaccine against a bacteria, Streptococcus pneumoniae. It's the most common bacterial cause of pneumonia in adults in the country. In any given year, we have 1 million people getting this, and 5 to 7% of people who get it die. It's a particularly nasty bacteria, and we have a vaccine against it, which is wonderful. There are recommendations for vaccine rates for this particular bacteria in adults. And if you're over 65, we want 90% of all adults in America to have this vaccine. And if you are between 19 and 64, we'd like 60% of you to get the vaccine if you have certain risk factors. Like if you have lung disease, you would benefit from getting this vaccine. Well, we took a look at 6 of our clinics in the community, and we realized that we were nowhere near those 90%, 60% benchmarks. We were somewhere in the 30% for the people over 65, and only at 15% for people who had diseases that put them at increased risk. So we had a long way to go. So we opted to take advantage of that period of time where people are in a hospital-based system and they're captive to the healthcare system and say, okay, you're in for a car accident. Let's see if we can do something to your vaccines. So we approached our 2 hospital groups, and it was the right time for Peace Health to partner with us, and we opted to create the appropriate tools and the systems and use their electronic health record and some of their staff to get people vaccinated while they're in the hospital for whatever reason, whether it was a stroke or a car accident or having a baby, whatever it was, we wanted to take advantage of that captive period. So you can see how well we did. The return on investment for this particular vaccine, a single hospitalization from bacterial pneumonia, we don't have 2019 dollars because most of these research studies were done some time ago, but a single hospitalization from this bacterial pneumonia is in the $15,000 range. And some of these people are really sick and they're on a ventilator and they're really expensive and they're in the hospital for a few weeks. But one vaccine for $80 could prevent a $15,000 hospitalization. So the ROI is really quite big. The other reason that we were really hopeful and successful in getting a hospital system to play with us or be in the same team is that hospitals are fined if people are readmitted to the hospital for the same diagnosis within 30 days and if they're a Medicare patient. So bacterial pneumonia is the number one cause. People get readmitted within 30 days for Medicare. Number two cause is congestive heart failure. But congestive heart failure can be made markedly worse if you have bacterial pneumonia. So this one dose can prevent the 2 number one causes of readmission and a hospital bill that hospitals will eat. So they were very interested in partnering with us. So we used the money we received from the legislature to hire a part-time person, 20 hours a week. We embedded that person in the hospital. We almost never saw him. He was there 20 hours a week, and he was working closely with their clinical team to identify people who would benefit from the vaccine, and we're lucky to be in a state that has a state immunization registry. Not every state does, but we do. So you zoom in on the registry and see, have they gotten the vaccine? And if they're in the hospital on screen A, and if they need the vaccine on screen B, the order is written, we tell the docs or the nurse practitioner, whoever is the attending for that big patient, to give the vaccine. And you can see how in the course of a year we gave over 700 doses. We did a wonderful job, and we're working to continue this. And just before I got here, we now have a PhD student who's going to take on this project, and I'm going to be on her dissertation committee, and I was talking on the drive over here. So they're going to pick it up, and we're not going to use this precious resource of the legislature to continue the project, but the precious resource of the legislature got this project going.
So how do you get them to get the follow-up second shot?
So it's a good question. So there are 2 different vaccines. And they have to be done a year apart, so you have to track it, and that's why we chose a group. We were going to start in long-term care facilities, and we figured it'd be harder to track for the next dose. So we started in hospitals because they can follow up in a Peace Health clinic, and we notify through their electronic health record their primary care provider. So secondly, and this is something we didn't expect, ACIP, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, it's the CDC committee that tells us how best to use these vaccines. They recently changed their recommendations for the vaccine, so many people will only need one, which kind of helps our project because you can come into the hospital and only get one and you won't have to get the second one.
That's bizarre. Yeah. I mean, I've personally.
You've had both of yours?
Well, I had one, and then they said they changed the vaccine, so I had to get the second series, and they said it only had to be a couple months apart, so...
Yeah, they're pharmacy. We could talk at length about the vaccine. You know, one's a conjugate vaccine, one's a polysaccharide vaccine. They're very different vaccines. They cover different serotypes of the bacteria, but there's a little bit of overlap.
Okay.
And they produce a different immunological response, which is why there's potentially benefit in getting both. But there's not as big a benefit as was originally anticipated. Hmm. And they're not cheap. You know, the flu vaccine you can get for $20. The cheapest of these vaccines is $80, and the other one's $170 wholesale. So it adds up fast, so you want to make sure you're spending your money well.
So that
my
was...
My daughter told me $125 on both of them yesterday.
Wow, you blended them.
So that was the vaccine work was the work that we started in 2017, 2019. We're continuing that program to support the AFIX piece with the clinics that are continuing to do it, because we have found that having that person in public health that follows up with those clinics keeps it going. It's often easy to start these new initiatives, kind of like Pneumovax, and Dr. Pat is still kind of following up with those hospitals to make sure they continue and find other strategies for keeping being involved with that. We did do AFIX a couple of years, several years ago, it was probably 5 or 6, in another clinic at the community health centers. And it was also very successful then, and it raised immunization rates by 12 or 14%. But it didn't continue because there wasn't somebody there who was helping to make sure that it, you know, that the value was understood and that the data was monitored and somebody that was continually checking on it. So I think that that is part of the value that public health brings, is the attention to the population level, like what we have, what the data says in our community, what the risks are, who needs additional support, and then having the expertise in someone like Dr. Pat, who can provide a lot of guidance around the things that are most needed in our community.
So which vaccines are part of the AFIX program?
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
Which vaccines?
Oh, for AFIX? Yeah. It's mostly the 2-year-old vaccines that are, and that's a good point too, because a lot of the healthcare providers are interested in working with us on that, because that is one of the metrics for the CCOs that those clinics are held to as well. So it's sort of a win-win. You know, they're already interested in helping to achieve those rates, as well, of course, for the health of the community and 2-year-olds.
So your metrics are people who went to the AFIX clinic, how does that compare to the total Lane part, I guess, 4-county population?
Yeah, what percentage of clinics participated in AFIX?
No, I'm looking at percentage of people,
who covered,
young people who should get the vaccine, who got it.
Uh-huh. I don't know that offhand, but I can certainly find out.
Mm-hmm. And certainly the whole issue of vaccines is something that we heard a lot about in the last session.
Right. Well, and the reason why another reason why we chose AFIX is because the research says that people really trust their providers. You know, it's not always a public health message that is well received if they don't have a relationship with us. You know, public health telling them they need to be vaccinated is not necessarily very convincing. But people do trust their own providers, and providers are very much in favor, obviously, of vaccination. So they're very effective in doing the counseling with individuals in their clinics. So it's a really good strategy and a great place to partner on those things. So that's been very effective. I don't know exactly what the percentage, but that would be a really good thing to find out. It will certainly, in the upcoming years, looking at outbreaks as well will be a really good metric.
If you send an email to Senator Beyer, mm-hmm. could you send one to Senator Manning and the commissioners?
Sure.
Yeah.
In all seriousness, that was quite an issue in the last session with people who were very fearful of that. I think the information they're giving is bad. I don't know that there's anything you can do to change that. Mm-hmm. These are, in my experience, very unusual because most of the people who are strongly opposed are fairly highly educated.
Right.
And you would not assume that these are the people who would be opposed to this. But mm-hmm. incredibly strong movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. It raised the level that, it made my office staff members very nervous. There were things and things, threats and things like that. So with this, administering this, everybody wants to know, or a certain group of people want to know, if there's opt-out provision that's part of this. I did notice the doctor said that once we go through the list, we inform the provider and they administer the vaccine, I think it's a good thing to have the vaccines, but not everybody agrees with me. So is there an opt-out provision that's also a part of this?
So, Senator, there is. We're in a state where we have an opportunity to opt out, and there's really two ways to do it. The patient's parents, guardian, can go to their provider, and the provider can educate them on the benefits and risks of vaccine. And then at the end, the provider can sign a sheet of paper for the school and say, this child is can't attend school without getting the vaccine. Or they can go online and view a module that the state health department has put together. Several of us have our voices on that module, and it's, I think it's 56 minutes long, and there's little quizzes with it, and they can get that sheet of paper too and turn it into the school. But one of the challenges is that if a parent or guardian chooses to not have their child vaccinated, when an outbreak occurs, they're not protected. And others in the classroom, whether it's a teacher or a custodian or a visiting parent who's helping with reading or something, may be at especially high risk. And we will still exclude those students during an outbreak who are not protected. And the plan for our paperwork from the health department is when a child starts school, if they are not going to be vaccinated, they're also supposed to receive a sheet of paper that says, oh, by the way, if an outbreak occurs and you're not protected, you will be excluded from school to make sure everybody else is safe in the school. So there was some challenge with that, too. Yeah. And we saw that last year with the whooping cough outbreak. Mm-hmm. We had plenty of teachers and parents who came to us and said, please exclude students from school because I want to be safe. We had teachers who have immunocompromised and they can't fight whooping cough. And their health is dependent upon the health of everybody in that classroom. And it was a real challenge for us as well, working with these conversations that don't always have the right answer.
Their arguments.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
Their argument, I happen to agree with that position, but their argument, those who oppose the vaccinations, is why are you concerned about us? Because if everybody else is vaccinated, there's no risk for them.
Well, so with some vaccines, that's absolutely true. Like the measles vaccine is fantastic. You get two doses, you're immune for life, it's 98% effective. But the whooping cough vaccine is only 75 to 80% effective, but it's the best thing we got. So the majority of people who get whooping cough actually have been prior vaccinated because the vaccine isn't perfect, but it's way better than not getting vaccinated.
It's pretty dangerous, too.
So it's a challenge. A real challenge.
I also think that we talked about this during session. This is Angie from OAJ. We talked about how if an individual is immunocompromised or if it's a child under 1 year old that hasn't been able to have their vaccines yet and there's traffic coming in and out of the home, that there's a risk involved with that as well. So.
Yeah. I mean, this is not necessarily a vaccine conversation for our entire time, but, we have high schools. I'm old enough to have never thought that I would have a high school that has a daycare in it, but most high schools do these days. And many of the students in the high school who are interested in family development or something like that, they work there. So we had a couple high schools with outbreaks, and there's babies in the high school. Well, who dies from whooping cough? Babies die from whooping cough. Adults don't die from whooping cough, babies do. And that's a real challenging situation.
Well, let me make this final comment about this. And that's one thing that never really surfaced. I had been contacted by a lot of folks, brand new babies, seniors, and they were afraid of going out because of their position or their inability their immune system may be compromised, but that never joined part of the conversation. It was all one-sided, and you know, if you believe in fear, then it becomes real to you. If you believe that something is very controversial and you stand on it and you dig in, it's like that, but you're not open to the other side, which is part of my job to look at it and get a balancing act from each perspective. So my hope is that moving forward, that all of the positions and stuff are coming out. The teacher, I never thought about the teacher that may have a issue or anything like that. So those are the kind of things I'm interested in hearing, and I think they need to become part of a larger conversation. But I also firmly support parents. If a parent chooses not to be vaccinated, that's their right. You know, I'm not going to tell them that they have to do that, but I am concerned about it. It's a bigger picture.
Dr. Warren, did you have other things on your agenda before we get into the discussion?
I can talk just so briefly about what we're doing going forward with the additional funding that we got, because we got more funding in the last biennium that allowed us to continue this work. We're also going to be applying the same kind of ideas and the same processes to working with clinics and expanding our work with clinical providers to addressing the rise of STDs in our county as well, sexually transmitted infections. So that we will work with providers about appropriate testing and treatment. So I'm really excited about that. The big piece for us locally is the ability to hire an infectious disease epidemiologist, which has been a huge gap here locally that we have not had somebody that can actually look at the data for us. This was a big problem actually during the pertussis outbreak because our community wanted to know, well, what's the rate of being getting pertussis among those who are vaccinated and unvaccinated? They see a large number of people who are vaccinated getting the disease and think, you know, it looks, you know, at first blush that there's really no protective value to the vaccine, which is absolutely not true. When we have been able to do that analysis, you see the attack rate is much, much, much higher in people who are not vaccinated. It's like 4 or 5 times the rate. So being able to have that data, though, to be able to give those families is really important because they need to see that. And it's, you know, we can tell them that we know that the vaccine is effective, but be able to show people your local data is a real benefit in public health communication. So that piece has been really important. And do you want to talk a little bit about the detailing work that you've been doing?
So, yeah, briefly, I'd be happy to. So there are a lot of things that we as a community need to do to address sexually transmitted diseases, and many of them are really up 300-400% in Lane County over the last 5 years, and during a time when our population has only gone up 6%. So this is real. This is not an influx of new people. On the provider side, there's maybe 2 main strategies. One strategy is we know there are people at higher risk than others. People who are in transactional sex, persons who are using substances, etc., they need to be tested much more frequently. And our assessment of our provider community is that is not happening. There are people who the recommendations are every 3 to 4 months they should be tested. And there are patients who are in high risk categories who are only getting tested when they get a syphilis rash or something. And that's not the way it should be. The other part is this what we call detailing. We kind of borrowed the phrase from the pharmaceutical business, where pharmaceutical reps would go out to the providers and would provide them the details of the drugs that they are marketing. And there's been public health detailing and academic detailing for quite some time. So we have begun detailing around the STDs, where we go direct to a provider office, get a sense of their practice, their clientele, so to speak, their patient panel, and understand their practice habits, and then start to nudge them in a direction of what would be healthier and provide better care for their patients. So I've been trained in that. I've been doing HIV detailing and detailing for the other bacterial STIs in a several county region. So we don't have enough people right now in the Coos and Curry outside of this county, so I've been spending some of my time there. Not on your salary. I take vacation when I do this. And I do counties and
that's
not make
that
clear. But we're working on bringing it in-house here with Dr. Guzman, one of our doctors here at Community Health Centers. And she's deputy health officer for 8 hours a week. So she'll be doing the detailing practice by practice, doctor by doctor, looking them in the eyes and saying, this is what we need to do to move forward to improve health in the community. So that's kind of a new strategy for our county.
That's it.
Okay, well, this was really great and in a really fast pace, and I really appreciate your organization and all of that. We did want to set up some time for the commissioners to have a little interaction, and so I'll be calling on commissioners after I jump in and ask the first question. Our legislative committee at Lane County Government has been interested in what might be happening in Salem, in the legislature, on the topic of local governments, cities and counties being preempted from taxing beer and wine. And I know that that is a controversial topic, and it was a controversial topic when Representative Beyer and Senator Sorensen and Representative Farr were in the legislature, and it still is now with both of you in your current roles. We're contemplating maybe coming forward with a proposal for opening that preemption to allow cities and counties, or just counties, or cities and counties, to be relieved from that preemption. Any advice that you have for us, given your current knowledge of where the legislature might be headed on that topic?
Good luck.
Good luck. It's still the beer industry controlling it. And is that a fair summary?
Yeah, I think you may have different perceptions. There's some interest among the legislature in making some increases in those. You well know it's very hard to do, very hard to get the votes to do that. I don't think, I don't know if the mechanics work well to do it on a county by county or city by city basis because of the way the collection system is set up. It's hard to do. I would have some concerns about that.
Yeah, just the mechanics of
it. Just the mechanics of doing that. On a statewide basis, I'm right with you. It's ridiculous where our beer and wine taxes are. They're way too low, and we need them for this kind of thing and other things that I spent the last session dealing with a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so maybe a statewide increase where the taxation system does not have to be changed, but the politics of, and that becomes another fight, but as opposed to a lifting of the preemption. And
yeah. Well, the money would, it would be, I think it's easier to pass a statewide than it is the authority for cities and counties to do that.
Yes.
My gut level is that's just not easy.
So much of our work.
But it'll all go, if we were to do that, almost all of it flows through to local governments, and that's mostly counties, who are dealing with that.
Because so much of what we deal with, I mean, Jay is our point person on Public Safety Coordinating Council. He's worked tirelessly on that. Commissioner Farr has a long history of being involved with the social services, especially the drug and alcohol side. And then our new commissioners, and myself, we're all aware that so much of what we deal with is the aftermath of this. And yet we have this very low state tax and, of course, a preemption against local governments that want to try to get the resources needed. So it's a tough problem. I mean, it was a tough problem when I was in the legislature, and I never helped to solve it.
Other than the fact that we haven't raised the beer tax in 50 years.
Yeah. So I was only involved in 30 years of it. So Commissioner, Senator Blanning, would you like to make any comments about the beer and wine tax, the preemption, as well as the level of taxation?
I actually agree with Senator Beyer. When we were dealing with OLCC, trying to get some fair compensations and stuff for some of our distillers in the district and around the state, that was an uphill battle. I'm not sure. What I would suggest, though, and I'm not opposed to it, is to bring something forward. At least start the conversation, continue the conversation. Since I've been there in the Senate, I find that a lot of bills don't do anything for 12 years or better, and it gets to some point where you do get some movement. So I'm not opposed to having a conversation, bringing it forward again. I think that we need to find a way to get more funding to counties and cities and stuff. But for me, I think I need your help in order to do that. And I got to say that Alex, where is Alex? Okay, yeah, he's got a direct pipeline into my office. I'm pretty sure that he's up there with Senator Byers as well and stuff. So whatever you come up with, then you know, bring it forward, and I don't mind having a conversation. You know,
I think if AOC and LOC together, but I think it makes more sense for counties if you were to come forward with a proposal to do that and dedicate the funding to, say, mental health. An increase in funding to deal with mental health, which really gets at a big chunk of your homeless population, and cast it in that way, it probably would have a better chance. I don't ever say it's going to have a good chance, because the record doesn't demonstrate that. But
is Mr. Omain still the lobbyist for the beer?
His daughter is.
Daughter, okay. Well, then it's a multi-generational thing here. I just remember spending a lot of time with Mr. Omain in the end. So do other commissioners want to ask a question? Commissioner Farr?
Well, you know, I'm interested in the Alcohol and Drug Policy Committee and the work of the ADPC, the statewide. And they have a mandate to provide a framework. And I think it's July 1st of next year that the deadline is. This is mandated, and it's outside of OHA, as far as I can tell. And my question, and this is to the senators, and I'm glad that people from OHA are in the room here, is, you know, some of the recommendations will involve funding local programs. I'm certain of that. The better, actually. And so how are they going to be able to move forward with their work when OHA really controls much of the revenue stream?
Say that again.
The Alcohol Drug Policy Commission has a mandate from the governor to create a framework by July 1st, I think it is, of 2020. And they're in process right now, but the recommendations really have to kind of sync with OHA. And are you guys going to be able to work together? Are things going to move forward? And I'd love for the senators to hear this, because this is really going to be a focus for the future, is how do we prevent addiction? We have a strong focus on addiction prevention in Lane County Health. And also, we recently passed a resolution at the request of Oregon Recovers. You guys know Oregon Recovers. That we would dedicate, it's a resolution, so part of the resolution was that we'd have done work toward addiction, and we will continue to do so. So the question is, you know, that synchronization between the commission and OHA.
So thank you, Commissioner Farr. This is Angie from OHA. I'm unable to speak on behalf of what the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission is doing, because that is, you know, a separate entity outside of the Oregon Health Authority. And we came here today to talk about public health modernization. And so I can say that that's a question that, when those recommendations are known and are officially come out, then I think that that's where the work is figuring out if those recommendations are going to go into legislation and et cetera.
The voice of government affairs. Thank you.
I can add one piece just in terms of how it fits with the public health division's work, if that would be helpful.
It would, and I really would like the senators to hear this, because you're going to hear about this in the short session and beyond. You know, as we work really increasingly more and more on addictions here at the local level, which is where much of the work is, where the focal point of the work is going to happen.
You mentioned the word prevention and treatment. I'm not sure how you do prevention, but treatment, we've been collectively different organizations working on that a long time and have some pretty proven success strategies there. Not told, but so I'm curious.
Sure. Much like the like Lane County has done a collaborative community health improvement plan, we at the state level, through our public health accreditation requirements, also are in the process of developing our 2020 to 2024 state health improvement plan. And so we have five areas that we're going to be working on. Their adversity, trauma, and toxic stress, economic drivers of health, so really what are the social factors that drive health outcomes, access to health care, institutional bias, and behavioral health. And so we're in the process right now of developing those goals, objectives, and strategies for each of those five areas. Related to behavioral health, we really see the public health aspect of that being prevention. And so in terms of how this relates to your earlier question around the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission, Dr. Richardson is sitting with us at the table to sort of fold in the work that they're doing into our state health improvement plan. And then I think where we're going to end up focusing is a little bit more upstream in terms of what are the types of policies and systems changes that could be forwarded that would really help people prevent addiction to alcohol and drugs from the very beginning.
Good. You nailed it. You said that they're sitting at the table helping mm-hmm. fold their recommendations
yep,
into,
exactly.
Into your plan. Mm-hmm. That's critical.
There's a couple pieces on that one. You're chasing down a path that I have been trying to understand better in the last year as I got through in the Ways and Means. I spent some time with our new behavioral health director, Steve Allen, yesterday going through a lot of this. And we have some built-in contradictions.
Unknown caller.
Excuse me. Shut that off.
I accidentally called
you
just now, sorry.
Cut it out, Alex. We have some built-in pipe, I think.
Having been in meetings with Senator Beyer, I could have told you that was his phone.
Some built-in contradictions in the system, I think. One, we've been pushing for a number of years now to integrate at the CCO level, now that's only Medicaid, mm-hmm. but integrate behavioral health in that. And I think that's created some conflict, or at least I'm hearing it in our community from the substance abuse people saying it's conflicting with their treatment modalities and how they deal with that funding-wise. Mm-hmm. And to a large extent, because the CCO, Trillium, and it has been in this case, had brought into the field a bunch of new practitioners to deal with general mental health issues, which has thinned the soup and is making it difficult for the Willamette treatment and emergence and some of the others to do their job. I mean, that's the complaint that I'm hearing. Then on the other hand, we have these 12 private specialty clinics who are going in the other direction. They want to move medical into theirs, and there's these fine people are going to figure out, does that make sense? I think we will continue that for a year and try and figure out if that makes sense enough. But I'm asking that question, how do you do that? And one of the things that Steve said the other day when he said there's some confusion because the counties get a lot of money direct and then there's the state funding and there's sort of a mismatch of understanding across the 36 counties and how that's supposed to work. Collaborative and how they're supposed to work together. And I will tell you that your providers in the community, when they're talking to me and James, and sometimes they're complaining that the county takes care of itself first rather than spending the money out. Now, I'm not saying that's accurate. I'm saying that is a perception that's out there.
We take care of the customers who need help.
So I think that's a key question. I would suggest, you know, Michael Bean has shared with me a video series that they had done in Seattle looking at homelessness, and I think it's a big thing, where the TV station up there did a long, in-depth study and the whole thing, and they got to the bottom and said the major cause of homelessness is substance abuse.
Well, that's
and you have to treat that one if you ever want to get a handle on the homelessness problem. And frankly, we have not put enough resources, largely because we don't have them, towards either of those problems.
Right. And we have robust programs, soon to be robust programs here that are addressing it. And Senator Beyer, thank you very much. And Cara, thank you, because the commission has been less active in the last few years than we would like to have seen them. But this framework potentially is a way for them to be significant, right down to the local level. And I really hope that this mission.
One of the real challenges in the next year as we implement CCO 2.0 is we now have two. You know, a lot of people complained about the one we had, and now we have two, and I have mixed feelings about that. I kept asking Director Allen about that. Said, how do we ever move towards a single-payer system, if that is a goal, when we're splitting the thing, and when you have two, how do you come up with a comprehensive community approach with different providers and making all that work?
Now, that's the
challenge to y'all who are working in the local community to make mm-hmm. that work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, the other side of that one is it's kind of nice to have some competition in the marketplace now.
I'd like to call on Commissioner Buck and then Commissioner Bernie and then maybe Commissioner Bozwich. had to step out, take his phone call. He'll be back, so Mr. Park.
So as a county, in the governor's proposed budget, we sent a letter through, probably Alex over here, for funding for, more funding for the modernization program and some public safety that Commissioner Bozovich is working on, requesting, you know, additional funding in those buckets. And it, you know, gives you pause to ask, like, would you like to be copied on those kinds of requests that go to that level? It would seem logical, whether it be those two subjects or other funding requests during that process, if you would like to be notified what we are doing on the county level.
Sure, it's helpful to know what you're doing.
Yeah.
It's hard for us to help if we don't know.
Yeah.
Alex does a great job in keeping me informed of what's happening. You know, he comes in and let me know that, hey, we need money. We need more money.
I got one message more.
Yeah. So, yeah, he does. I mean, I'm not sure that I get all
of
it.
I thought Alex was a labor negotiator.
Yeah. So I'm not quite sure if the letters that you send directly to the governor, if I'm getting them. But when it comes down to the actual money portion, both Senator Byers and I are on the Old Ways and Means Committee. And at some point, we will find out about it, but it is helpful to know in advance.
I think what we're trying to do as a with staff and the board is really pay more attention to the agency request budgets and then advocate to the governor to stick those, some of the things we see moving forward, into her governor's request budget, because our assumption is when it gets to Ways and Means, if it's in the GRB, it's sort of easier for you to support it rather than us coming later in the session with a discrete request. And so I sort of wanted to get your feedback on that assumption.
My exposure is it's always better to get it into the governor's budget if you can get the start there. But you're going to hear the reaction from the legislature. And some of this is true, as we just tell the governor, thank you very much for your budget, put it aside and start our own.
But the history, I think, is that the legislature does start with the governor's budget and does make adjustments off of the budget. We'll just do our best to keep
it informed. Less so than it used to be.
Yeah, and it's a little more.
But the reality is the governor's budget is the governor's budget, because largely those programs pre-exist. And it's really hard to get a program started, and understandably, it's really hard to change it once it's there. And cost are cost.
Did you have any other follow-up to that before I call on Commissioner Bernie? Get ready.
No, that's good. Just for us to know that
what
we
would
should
be really
CC'ing
helpful.
Yeah.
What would be really helpful is if AOC had clear positions and not so many of them. Having 100 priorities is not helpful. It's like having none.
Well, let me add from my experience is that when the governor had line item out the Junction City Hospital, I was part of a group team that led the charge. Actually, I spoke to the governor about that. He asked me what was my priorities for that, and I said keeping that Junction City Hospital open. And she was flexible enough where we kept it open. So when you have these things like these budgets, community corrections, for example, big deal. We get a lot of pushback across the state on that. Didn't get funded, even though it was in there. If I had something in advance saying that, hey, I don't see this on the governor's list, I can reach out to the governor, or legislators can reach out to the governor and try to get ahead of this before it actually comes down, because once it gets there, it's pretty much a done deal, from what I understand. There are flexibilities in some things and stuff, but, being able to advocate early on in a process is always a lot better than trying to play catch up later on.
Let me put a touch of budget reality out there. least the perception among those working the budgets and think now is we put Ways and Means put the largest amount into reserves this session that I've seen in the time I've been working there. And the reason we did it is we think that when we work on the next budget, we're going to be in a recession.
Yeah.
And so it's going to be difficult to maintain what we've got, let alone go much farther than that. I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah.
But that seems to be what people, the economists looking at it and believing now.
Okay. Commissioner Bozovich, are you ready to ask your question?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. And then we'll call the commissioner.
Thanks a lot, Pete.
Hey, and then we'll, yeah, well, you know, you're on the phone, so you figure you're going to be on the phone.
Yeah. Yes. So, you know, I spent the last couple days involved with the Every 15 Minutes program out at Elmira High School. So I was around high school kids most of the last couple days. And, you know, as I think about, you know, great, we're working on vaccines and STDs and all that stuff, but the issue of mental health is really foremost in my mind also. You know, we're talking to the kids there about distracted driving, drunk driving, but, you know, suicide become the number two killer of teens, and that just, you know, that particular prevention, and when you start talking about drug and alcohol addiction, you really have to get to the kids, because more often than not, that starts before 18. Some of the behaviors that lead to that, so, and it's almost always self-treatment of a mental health issue is what it really comes around to. So getting down to that youth level of mental health, and it's a resource issue. So getting back to taxes and Pete, just for your information, I sit on AOC's governance committee. We supported changes to the increases to the beer tax in the past, and particularly when it was targeted to addiction and prevention programs. So I know that previous little increases in the beer tax, AOC has support. So I don't know if we have to come up with a new proposal again, but we've been supporters and taken a support position on those bills in the Ledge Committee. But the bill I'm kind of interested in, or the issue I'm kind of interested in, is the retail cannabis. I've learned to call it that.
Thank you.
And the taxation there, either the redistribution of the funding formula that came out of Measure 91, or in particular the bill that I think was proposed one time, which is to allow for a higher level of local taxation, retail level, and allow counties to reach inside municipalities with their portion of the tax. I think we talked about bringing it up to 8 cents and allowing counties to have 3 of that 8 cents, and where the cities could go from 3 to 5 cents on the tax. That would really, because there's virtually no retail shops in rural Lane County outside of municipal boundaries. Eugene gets millions of dollars in retail cannabis taxes. Ours, you know, at the retail side, what would we get, 60,000 or something last year? Yeah, it doesn't really do anything to help. If that change alone happened, you know, the added resource we'd have to be able to reach, you know, to add, you know, staff and people to reach out to the youth and increase our suicide prevention and our mental health outreach to youth. You know, it's where it all starts, you know. It's where we should really be, you know, a lot of focus should happen. But, you know, there's two places I think in particular, you know, I'd like to hear from you guys about the possibility of, you know, you already talked about increasing beer tax, and I'm happy to go back to AOC and work on that. But there's anything about maybe changing distribution of retail cannabis or changing the allowance for local taxation.
Well, no, what I would start with is that, you know, what is your relationship with Eugene and the county? You know, I remember that it was set up, but I don't know if, you know, you may know more about it than I do, if it was the state that was overlooking it, or I know that the city and county were given the authority to, you know, to raise tax and stuff off of the sale of cannabis products and stuff. But one of the things that I would like to see is that the county and the city work together before me, as, you know, being in the state, saying that you have to do this, because all counties and all cities are different. And, you know, I don't want to get caught in the middle of a family feud, you know.
I'll just follow up by saying we have a number of county problems that are related to the land use and the controversy over the farming and the neighborhood and the effect of it. But the taxation, that the money that cities and counties get, is based on where it's sold, not where it's grown. And so we don't have, as Jay points out, we only get $60,000, and they're getting like lots more. And I would say, well, Eugene residents are doing their very best to drive up that revenue. And I get it that cities also have connected problems because of the sale of retail cannabis. But what it was left out of the legislative structure is, we don't get revenue based upon where it's grown. We get revenue based on where it's sold. And we don't have very many places where you can buy retail cannabis outside of cities. So, you know, I'm just saying, I think that we have a real good point here is, you know, there's been some pretty serious neighborhood conflicts over this. People have come in, maybe not with pitchforks, but they've come in at odds over it, and we've had to play mediating role in it.
But I don't disagree with you. I think it was a very poorly structured initiative, but it is what it is. That's what the people voted on, and it's very hard to change that realistically. The difference, we went three sessions with the Joint Cannabis Committee working through that, and by the end of the third session, coming up on the last session, people who had done it, and I was one, said, put it somewhere else. No one wants to be on a cannabis commission. Committee. So the perspective on that, one, it was no longer, you know, a joint bicameral process. It was separated into two, and there were like four or five different committees that were dealing with different aspects of it. So it was very hard to get a clear picture of what people wanted. Most of the issues that we hear in Lane County is around the medical side. People thinking that they've been put out of business and that the patients are not getting their medicine. That's the common phrase, doctor. Patients are not getting their medicine because their former providers, who are all about medicine, have now become more interested in green. That's the reality situation. We don't have a very good enforcement system through OLCC, because OLCC gets no money off the sales. They get it only from a licensing fee. If I were structuring it, I would start there and make sure that we could enforce the law, which we cannot very well now, and we're getting like that. And then I think the other piece is, I think you're right, I would rather see the money go towards treatment, and with some towards local law enforcement, although I don't see a lot of local law enforcement problems with it, other than that has to deal with people dealing with the aftermath of it, and, you know, substance abuse situations. But the reality of changing that, I think it'd be really hard to do that. Probably.
Well,
everybody wants a piece of the action.
Alex, do you want to add something to that before I go on to Commissioner Bernie?
Emphasize the piece that Commissioner Bozovich said, and that the inconsistency is that one of the really interesting reforms that came out of House Bill 3100 for public health modernization was the authority of the local public health authority vested at the Board of Commissioners to pass an ordinance that would take effect inside of city limits. And that, you know, is something that Rob Ovett worked on, and, you know, it's a very interesting evolution. And then you have this other work of the Joint Marijuana Commission that did, in its wisdom, say that counties could only collect a retail tax on those that were actually in the county. So there's sort of this weird inconsistency between policy on the one hand, a local public health authority, and on the other, as a taxing entity.
You could probably answer more than that, but I don't think most legislators even know what the local health authority is.
So we're working on that. This is Angie from OHA, and last session we had Senate Bill 29, which was our housekeeping bill that had sections 51 through 110, I believe, and we pulled those sections out so that we could work together on clarifying language around local public health authority, the governing body of the local health, public health authority, and et cetera, because it was very confusing and everyone in the system uses different language. So we're working closely with our partners at AOC. We've got, you know, our AOC partners, Andy Smith, and our CLO partners that we're having the conversation with, and then it'll be something that will be fully vetted with all of the membership afterward.
May I say something before my battery wears out?
Yes.
Do you have to?
Yes, please do.
No. Whoever said, do I have to, the answer is no. So if you would prefer.
It was Lee. Just poking you, Joe.
I know. Trust me, I've been. So as someone who, at this moment in time, am very much an advocate of treatment. I'm sorry. I've been treated. I just had a surgery. First, I want to thank the staff from the state agencies. I found this very informative, and I just want to thank you for that, because any words I say really don't pertain to the politics of how we allocate out far too few resources to deal with the context that these problems are part of. First, I wanted to ask Alex, did you say there was a joint marijuana commission, or was that just an oxymoron? You wanted to say it twice.
No, it was a joint marijuana committee.
I know, I'm being silly. Yeah. Just as I'm being silly when I say
it. Yeah. Old joke.
I understand.
It's new for me. I'm new at this stuff.
And we also,
based on the current policy of how counties receive resources from retail cannabis sales, it sounds like they are directing counties to develop retail cannabis superstores in unincorporated areas. And that, to me, is some of the lack of logic that permeates some of this stuff. I just want to share, Dr. Ludke, when you talked about return on investment, so I just had a surgery, and at the surgery center, the bill, i.e., the cost, which I assume are worked into ROI formulas, was over $9,000. The amount that was allowed to be billed, because we have great insurance at the county, was under $3,000.
Good job.
When you talk about ROI, and we're talking about crazy numbers that make no sense, which numbers are you referring to?
So the numbers that I quoted were... This is Dr. Ludke. The numbers that I quoted, we had the wholesale cost of the vaccine, which was half purchased by us in the county and half purchased by the Peace Health Foundation. And then we used ARC. It's the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. It's a federal agency within Health and Human Services. We used the ARC data on hospitalization cost. So that's where our numbers came from. But you're right. The various insurance companies negotiate different rates. So they may bill $10,000, but they only get paid $5,000.
Gotcha. Thank you. And like, for example, I pay, without insurance, $400 for a vial of insulin that costs about $13 to produce and distribute. But so as we're looking at numbers in healthcare, it's just hard for me to understand. Senator Beyer, quick question, if I may. Did you mention that Ways and Means put more money in a reserve fund than they ever have before?
Yes.
And how
I don't know about ever before. In recent years...
May I ask how much that was?
I don't know the number, but it's in, I think, do you happen to know? A few hundred million.
I think it was a couple hundred million at least.
Yeah. In the scale of the state budget, it's not that much. I mean, because you're talking about a state budget total state budget of something in the neighborhood of $35 billion. But I think it's a couple, it's a, for some reason, the $200 million seems to be what I remember.
And that's in anticipation of a downturn in the economy?
Yes. As well as the potential for bad fire years, which we didn't have, and other things.
Right. And how much is the kicker refunding to Oregonians that's already been collected on the basis of an economist's projections?
North of $1 billion.
Right. Again, it speaks to the numbers we're talking about. I guess the only other thing I would like to point out, and it doesn't directly relate, and I apologize, blame my drugs. Please, the other commissioners know that they're no excuse. I talk like this, but please do that. It seems like many projects, the results of this project are very positive, and yet the context for which they're occurring are getting worse and worse. Would you say that that's a correct statement or no?
I would say that's not a correct statement, and here's why. In the vaccination realm, there was a question earlier about what percentage of two-year-olds are vaccinated. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of different vaccines that are recommended, but if you blend them all together, we're around 90% of two-year-olds are at the place they should be for the 14 common vaccines that we have for them. That rate is not getting really worse. It's been stable-ish, around 90% for some years. I've been in Oregon for 9 years. It's been about that for 9 years. The way people have chosen to not get vaccinated has changed. So more people are opting out, as you know, physically opting out with a piece of paper that we can actually track. And it says, my parent or guardian is saying, do not get vaccinated.
Right.
We didn't have that ability to track it before. So we're at about 90%. The STDs are getting worse. A couple of them have, we think, maybe reached the peak of their curve, and we're starting to bend them down a little bit, but they're still well above historical norms. There is one good, I shouldn't say a good STI. There is one good note that the HIV, we have one new HIV case a month in Lane County, basically 12 a year. We've been stable since I've lived here, about that number. And the reason I think we're stable while the other STIs are going up is because of two reasons. We have antiretroviral treatment. We have the medications. We're a state that expanded Medicaid. People get these drugs. Sorry, Commissioner, I didn't hear you. So we have the ability to treat persons with HIV, and I think that's a really big deal. And the second issue is we have a really broad-based campaign around HIV that we kind of don't have around chlamydia or gonorrhea or syphilis. Those words are really scary to people. HIV seems to have been routinized in the community, and we have a better opportunity to have a conversation around HIV.
Mm-hmm. Thank you all very much, and I hope my questions were not that off topic.
Commissioner,
yeah, go ahead, yeah. Senator Manning.
Just want to go back to a question or concern that Commissioner Bosevich had. I agree with you. We need to have more funding to address mental health issues in high schools and stuff. And I'm committed to raising that bar, increasing that. The avenue may not be through cannabis, but there are other avenues that we can use in order to get that. So I'm on board with you. Also want to let you know, too, the many conversations that we've had around community corrections, that's going to be coming up during our November pledge days and stuff. So I've already talked with the Senate President's office saying that we need to put funding in here stuff. So thank you for, you know, bending my ear a little bit, you know, letting me know how important this was. And so because of you and your efforts and stuff, and we're going to get you some money. I don't know how much, but it's on the agenda, a hot item.
This is a hot, go ahead.
I did want to comment to your comment, Jay. The issue of counseling and mental health support was the number one thing that students mentioned as the Student Success Committee went around the state. Not the adults, but the kids. They all mentioned that was the biggest need that they had in their school. which I found really interesting. And as a result of that, there is a specific funding stream within the Student Success Act that was passed, specifically dedicated to dealing with that issue in schools, and particularly suicides. I don't know all the particulars on that. If you really want to understand what we're doing on that one, Senator Roblin is there. The other piece on the mental health issue in general, that is the number one priority of the Senate President, has been for a long time, working on that. And he's looking at that as a priority as he finishes out his last term in the Senate. But we've got, as legislature will do, both the House and the Senate created a mental health committee that's working, or task force, working in the interim, and not to be outdone, the governor just appointed a task force on mental health. So lots of discussion on mental health in the next year.
Good. I wanted to call on Mr. Kyler because I think he had a few questions.
This is what I wanted to ask. Going back to public health modernization, we were in our legislative committee earlier today, and we had our emergency manager there, and she had an interesting statistic that said for every dollar spent on mitigation, right, they save $6 on response. And I think the promise of public health modernization is that, but I don't know that we have that sort of nice, accurate statement to make, but I'm, you know, interested to hear, particularly in Dr. Lutke's earlier comments and even Commissioner Burney's comments about the costs. I mean, isn't that what we're trying to get to? And can we get to a number that, or a statement like that, that we know is backed up by data?
We have those for some programs, especially national programs that have more data because they're very standardized. So like the Nurse Family Partnership Home Visiting Program has a very high ROI, as does WIC as the nutritional program, because there is the database and because it's a very standardized approach. I don't think we have anything that very similar to, say, STI investigation or treatment work.
Yeah, we have it for tuberculosis in public health. The ROI is about 104-1, because TB is a nasty disease and lasts treatment for months and months and months. But we don't have it for chlamydia. We don't have it for gonorrhea, sadly.
Yeah. Well, what we could do, and this is Kara Biddlecombe with the Public Health Division at OHA, we did do some estimates, some modeling back in 2016 with the public health economist who sort of took the best that we had from the literature and applied it to Oregon. And so we could definitely pull that and send that around. I think that's the most accurate local assessment of what public health modernization can do.
I will say one challenge, Alex, and you can tell I like to talk about STDs. So just take chlamydia. It's the bacterial STD that's the most for us. We can tell you for certain that our county will have about 3,500 cases this year. We can break it out by sex, male, female, the percentage. We can tell you the age groups pretty well, not perfectly, but pretty well, in a predictive model. But what we don't know at public health, it's a reportable disease, and we get the numbers, but we don't get the cost data. We have no idea what it costs. So we rely on our CCOs and our clinical partners to share that data. But it's such a variable continuum of treatment. So one person might get chlamydia, and they'll get an antibiotic prescription, and the whole treatment is $100. Someone else might scar their fallopian tubes and end up with infertility, and it'll be tens of thousands of dollars for them before they get to get pregnant. Others might have a deeper infection we call pelvic inflammatory disease. They might be hospitalized for 2 weeks. It'll be a $50,000 bill just from that one bacteria. So it's a really broad clinical spectrum. Mm-hmm. So it's hard, I think, to aggregate all of those responses.
Mm-hmm. And I would just add, I know that we've had these conversations throughout the last session, but as different sectors start to recognize that there's an impact to human health, for example, natural resources, you know, if we've started coming to the table when we talk about wildfire and forest management, we've come to the table. Obviously, we implement the Safe Drinking Water Act for the state, and so we have drinking water services. As different areas start to recognize that there is a seat at the table to talk about the impact to human health, we don't have data yet about what the cost savings could be to be from that public health lens and involvement, and what you could do to, you know, how much money you could save and how many lives or human health you could save by, you know, starting to think about prevention and have that discussion about the impact to human health. And so I think part of modernization is really being able to create a system that's responsive, not just to you know, different silos of diseases, but to emerging threats. And so I think that that's another piece of this that I don't want to lose in, you know, kind of leaving the conversation. I really think that that's an important piece to public health modernization and those goals.
I'm just struck that, you know, when we were talking about, for example, justice reinvestment, right, we were walking around the Capitol building saying, you know, we're going to spend $600 million on prison construction, or we can move those dollars into the more community treatment and avoid at least some of those costs. And I think the more public health modernization can be sort of a confusing thing. It would be great if we had walk around the Capitol saying, invest $50 million now to save $250 million in treatment, or however you want to characterize it, but good, simple message.
Yeah.
And I beg your pardon, Senators, and Andrew, and Cara, Doug, Kaylee, thank you for being here, Joaquin, thank you. And I apologize, I have to leave to a meeting that starts at 2:30 that was scheduled quite a long time before this one was. So, thank you.
Thank you, and that's a great segue that I also have a meeting I have to go to at 3 o'clock, so.
Sounds like the meeting's over.
I need to. I feel like everybody's gotten to say everything at least one time through, and I just wanted to conclude the meeting by saying, number one, thank you so much to our legislative guests for taking time out of your busy schedules, our state partners, and we can't thank you enough. I mean, this is really important to have a great relationship, and I see that good relationship, and we really appreciate that. And the commissioners and staff from Lane County Government that were able to put together this meeting. I want to thank Dr. Warren in particular for really making a nice, tight presentation and doing the best she could to make this all work out. So thanks very much, and our meeting is adjourned. Thanks, Joe, for hanging in there.
Oh, no, thank you all so much. And Rwanda, I look forward to